The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. So, according to the Biden administration, that arsenal of truth and integrity, our spiraling gas prices, such as over $5 a gallon in California, and they're just going increasingly up even as I speak, these great gas prices, according to Biden, are on account of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. How do we know that? Because they said so. Oh, I believe them, at least as much as any of the other drivel coming out of this administration's mouth, which means I accept their facts about as much as I believe in Santa and the North Pole. Let's not forget the Easter Bunny. Easter is around the corner, and we shouldn't leave out the Tooth Fairy. My friends, don't just listen to what politicians say in the present. Listen to what they said in the past. Biden was clear that he wanted to get rid of fossil fuel. He said it again and again, although he occasionally lied and denied saying it, but he's on record multiple times despite his denials. He's surrounded by people whose agenda is the Green New Deal. Think. He shuts down the Keystone Pipeline. Instead, he begs countries like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela for oil. And then he goes and he also begs Iran for oil. Iran, where they chant death to Israel and death to America. Iran, where they're developing a nuclear bomb. So of course our prices are going to go up. It's called supply and demand. It's called people manipulating us. Why is he doing this? Under Trump, we were energy independent. Just what about this policy makes sense? Well, in their minds, it does make sense. It makes a lot of sense because they're trying to make sure gas stays expensive. That's the whole idea. They want it to be expensive. So expensive, we will be forced to drive electric cars instead, thus reducing the carbon emissions. Of course, they're hoping you forget that for electricity to be harnessed, we need a power source. And often that power source itself is gas or oil or coal. The truth is, they don't really care if you drive an electric car or return to the horse and buggy. Because they don't really care about the environment of the planet. What they care about is control. To them, the Green New Deal is in the same category as COVID, an excuse for government regulation, redistribution of wealth, and basically a chance to make life miserable for anybody who up to now had the audacity to be independent or well off without government assistance. I'm tempted to talk about how stupid our president is, because he is stupid, but those around him know exactly what they are doing. They are not stupid. They are evil, self-righteous, narcissistic, lying, deceitful, shameless, contemptible blowhards. That's who they are. Now let me tell you who I am. I am Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
Thank you.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome to our sanctuary, a sanctuary for skeptics and doubters, a place where you can ask Bible questions and still be treated with respect instead of being lectured that you don't have enough faith. All of us have had questions about the Bible, and today's passage is an extremely controversial one. I'm reading from Judges chapter 11, verses 29 through 39. Now, I'll read that aloud in a moment. First, some background. The book of Judges is not usually studied by Christians in a lot of detail. Many Christians I talk to are virtually unfamiliar with the book. Oh, sure, there are some well-known Bible heroes from the Judges, Samson, Gideon, Deborah, but today we're going to discuss a man who isn't as widely known, and those who do know him like to talk about him on Atheist 100 Things You Hate About the Bible sites. His name has an unusual pronunciation in English. I've actually found various pronunciations, but the most common one is the obvious one, awkward as it may be. It's pronounced Jeff. Not to be confused with Jethro of the Beverly Hillbillies, Jephthah. Actually, Jephthah is listed in Hebrews chapter 11, that special hall of fame of Old Testament heroes. Despite this honor, many think of him less as a hero and more as an anti-hero because this man sacrificed his own daughter to God. And in those days, you made a sacrifice by taking people to the altar and slaying them. How do we explain this? Well, we'll start by taking a deep breath and by backing up. Jephthah was one of the few people of ancient times whose mother was a working career woman. She was a prostitute. Two of his brothers drove him out because they had a different mother, and they said, "You are not going to get any inheritance in our family because you are the son of another woman." So he fled the land of Gilead and settled in the land of Tob. A group of adventurers later gathered around him and followed him. We don't know much about these adventurers, but possibly they were kind of a Robin Hood-like band, Jephthah and his merry men. All we know for sure is that when his previous town, Gilead, up in the northwest of Israel, was attacked by Ammonites, people knew they could count on Jephthah. Yeah, they knew they could count on the very guy that they had thrown out. They said, "Come on, be our commander that we might be able to fight the Ammonites." And he says, "Right. Oh, yeah, sure. You throw me out, make me fend for myself, and now I'm supposed to come back to help you? Oh, Jephthah, come on. Are you still sore about all that? It's us, your old friends. Where's your sense of humor?" Okay, enough paraphrasing. That was all accurate, but obviously my paraphrase thrown in. I'm going to read now from the text itself as we continue and advance the story. Judges chapter 11, verses 29 through 39. This is after they've recruited him to come back and help. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. He crossed Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, "If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering." Then Jephthah went over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into his hands. He devastated 20 towns. Then Israel subdued Ammon. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines? She was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh, my daughter, you have made me miserable and wretched because I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." "My father," she replied, "you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me just as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites. But grant me this one request," she said. "Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends, because I will never marry." "You may go," he said, and he let her go for 2 months. She and the girls went into the hills and wept because she would never marry. After the 2 months, she returned to her father, and he did to her as he had vowed. And she was a virgin. All right, how do we unpack this? It's one of many Old Testament stories that are very difficult for people to fathom. Now, skeptics and atheists have no trouble unpacking it at all. They just say God is cruel. And that's understandable. Here's my response. Whose idea was this? God's or Jephthah's? There's a lesson to be learned here. Don't shoot off your big mouth. There's another lesson to be learned here. If you do shoot off your big mouth and take a vow that God did not ask you to take, go back, apologize, and ask him to release you from it. Now relax, I'm not talking about a marriage vow. That's a good vow. I'm talking about bad vows, idiotic vows, and not just vows. I'm talking about all the times we think we are obeying God, and instead we are just being stupid. Yes, our hearts are in the right place, but our heads are in the wrong place. Had this man gone before God and asked to be released from the vow, I am convinced God would have released him. Can I prove this? No, because it doesn't say that, and it doesn't say that he tried to get out of the vow. So I am speculating, but it is reasonable speculation, and here are the reasons. First of all, God is a God of mercy. Even in the Old Testament, King David was guilty of the sin of both adultery and murder. Could have been put to death for either one of those offenses, but Nathan the prophet said to him, "The Lord has removed your sin. You shall not die." Perhaps even more significant, we have biblical precedent. Another story, a similar vow. This one comes from 1 Samuel chapter 14, back when Saul was the king of Israel. And he said, "Any man who eats before I avenge myself against the Philistines will be put to death." His son Jonathan did not hear about that and helped himself to some wild honey. His son who had helped them win the battle. I'm reading now from 1 Samuel 14, starting with verse 44. Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die, he who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never! As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Also, very important, God has revealed that he personally detests the idea of human sacrifice. One of the very reasons he commanded the Israelites to go subdue the land of Canaan is because the nations there were sacrificing people on the altars. I'm reading from Leviticus chapter 20. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Say to the Israelites, any Israelite or any alien living in Israel who gives any of his children to Moloch must be put to death. The people of the community are to stone him.'" Catching this? The ones God wants to die are the people people making the sacrifices. He doesn't want human sacrifices. He wants to destroy the human beings making human sacrifices. He continues, I will set my face against that man and I will cut him off from his people, for by giving his children to Molech, he has defiled my sanctuary and profaned my holy name. If the people of the community close their eyes when that man gives one of his children to Molech and they fail to put him to death, I will set my face against that man and his family and will cut off from their people both him and all who follow him in prostituting themselves to Molech. All right, now I know what some of you are thinking. Bob, what about the time God commanded Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac? Context, my friend. Context. Yes, Abraham was prepared to carry out that order, for that was a common method of worshiping many gods in those days. However, the lesson of that story is God was simply testing Abraham's obedience. We must remember how God stopped him in the middle and said, do not lay a hand on the boy. It was a test. God says, now I know that you love me above all else. Actually, now Abraham knew that he loved God above all else. But the bottom line, God stopped it. He did not make the sacrifice. Well, here's another objection. What about God sending his own son Jesus to die? God himself sacrificed his son. My friends, who was God's son? God himself. It was an incarnation. We're talking about the mystery of the Trinity. God is three, yet God is one. This is not really God sending a son. I know it's phrased that way, but the son is the middle person of the Trinity. God himself came down and paid for our sins. Yeah, you're thinking, but aren't children to die for their parents' sins? Doesn't the Bible teach that? Nope. The Bible teaches quite the opposite. Deuteronomy 24. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children for their fathers. Only for his own guilt shall a man be put to death. This is elaborated on more later in Ezekiel 18. Yet you ask, why does the son not share the guilt of his father? Since the son has done what is just and right and has been careful to keep my decrees, he will surely live. The soul who sins is the one who will die. The son will not share the guilt of the father, nor will the father share the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous man will be credited to him, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against them. Here's another objection. Well, what about Achan? Achan's entire family was put to death for his sin of stealing. That's in Joshua chapter 7. My friends, in all probability, they participated in the crime. Remember, the ages of his children are not given, and his children could have been grown adults still living with their parents, very common living arrangement in those days. My point, if Jephthah had known the scriptures better, he would have had a better understanding of God. He at least had the law of Moses, although how much they were studying it in those days, the days of the judges, well, that's questionable. But we make the same mistakes today. We develop false ideas about God because we do not study the scriptures properly, even when they're at our disposal. This gives us a view of a cruel God or a contradictory God. In the early church, many of the monastics slept with cords and rocks and wood in their beds in order to make a sacrifice for God. Well, that was very noble in their intentions. They might just as easily impress God by getting a good night's sleep. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
This is Bob Siegel. With the wiring in your home, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. For all you know, he may have gotten his license by sending in three serial box tops.
Hey, these things happen. There's nothing wrong with my wiring. wiring. Houses burned down. You wanted a guarantee? You should have ordered the deluxe package.
Folks, play it smart. Call WNS Electric Incorporated. They specialize in contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, WNS takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I use them myself, and I wouldn't call anyone else. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for WNS Electric. License number 480539. WNS Electric.
Check out these terrific customer reviews for Bob Siegel's science fiction novel, Push the Winds Around. Another winner from Mr. Siegel. I've always loved the time travel stories, and this one takes a creative approach. Like H.G. Wells' classic, it delves into morals and metaphysics. And as any good time travel mystery, it leaves you satisfied while raising questions at the same time. Here's another review. Quick, thought-provoking, enjoyable read. And just one more. My kind of book. Adventure, fun, excitement, suspense, time travel, love, and a day at the beach. What's not to like? A great book to lose yourself in. Happy reading. Push the Winds Around. Available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
One of the strongest objections to the accuracy of the Bible is that manuscripts in our possession are not the originals, but rather copies. My friends, that is the same for all ancient history, and you usually don't see people complain about other ancient history. There are always new rules for the Bible. But yes, copies. They had to make copies in those days. What else would we have expected them to do? Save it on their hard drive? The original manuscripts to the Bible have either been lost or destroyed in the passage of time. Before the writing materials of papyrus made from the leaves of the Nile River or parchment made from animal skin were replaced with vellum made from a better quality of animal skin, scribes had to copy all writings. This means that for many years, the best, oldest, and most complete collection of Hebrew and Aramaic manuscript copies of the Old Testament, also known as the Tanakh or Holy Scriptures to the Jews, dated about 1010 AD. Now you see the problem? That's AD. The Old Testament is supposed to be the BC stuff. This text, copied by the Masoretes, was known as the Ben Asher text, named for the family that preserved it for many years. Now the Jewish Talmud explains the very careful way scripture was copied. For this reason, Orthodox Jews have been confident over the years that their text was an accurate collection. I'm sure you will not be surprised to hear that this did not satisfy Bible critics or religious skeptics. Oh yeah, sure. Do you realize how much could have been rewritten and changed since this time of the original autographs in AD 1010? All at once, like a stroke of lightning, everything changed in the year 1947. Two Arab boys in the Judean desert were having fun throwing rocks into a cave. Suddenly they heard something break and shatter. Inside were large clay jars containing rolled up scrolls. Authorities were notified, and in no time at all it was discovered that this cave was one of many once inhabited by the Essenes, a kind of Jewish cult who withdrew from the rest of Israel because they did not agree with the religious moral teachings of Israel's current leaders. In neighboring caves, additional jars of manuscripts were found. Literally thousands of scrolls were uncovered, most of which discussed the teaching and customs of the Essenes. Included were portions of every single book of the Old Testament, with the exception of Esther, and the entire Book of Isaiah. When compared to the Ben Asher text, they showed virtually no difference, nothing of any significance. And yet, the Dead Sea Scrolls date between 120 to 150 B.C. This bridges a thousand-year gap. No, they are not the originals, but the Dead Sea Scrolls testify that the Jewish scribes were indeed as careful as they claimed. With reasonable certainty, we can trust that the previous 1,000 years of scripture copying were done just as carefully as the Jews have always claimed. What a thrill when I finally got a chance to visit Israel and see for myself the caves of Qumran and, in a museum, many of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is Bob Siegel with a little help from ancient history, making the obvious obvious.
I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Welcome to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Always good to be joined by my producer, Brendan Thomas.
Hello, Bob. How are you doing tonight?
Doing okay. How did the time change work out for you this morning,
step forward? Yeah, no problem at all. I actually woke up at 7, so that means it would have been 8. So... I had no issues with it. So as long as it wasn't on a weekday, you know. But I hear that Congress might be saying that this will be the last time we ever do that. Who knows?
Oh, no more daylight savings time?
Yeah, they're trying to pass a bill this year to get rid of it.
That would be wonderful. I'm so sick. Particularly the hand clocks are easy. Adjusting my car.
It's another story.
It's another story. But I figured out a foolproof method this time. I just left it alone in the fall. And voila, this morning it was just automatically sprung forward. It was amazing.
I don't want to brag about my car too much, but it automatically updates for me. So.
Oh, that would be it. You'd think if they could put a man on the moon, they could do that.
Right? So a couple of things. Number one, congratulations to Jim Barrier for probably getting a college basketball championship correctly, because he's predicted Gonzaga.
Did one of Barrier's predictions actually come true?
Not yet. It just came out with the brackets today, and I cannot deny that Gonzaga has a pretty good chance of winning. But I will try my best to make sure that does not happen, but we'll see.
Well, it ain't over till the fat lady sings and Jim Barrier guesses the song.
That's right. So in the meantime, I want to say 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, we did a review for a movie, and I thought we should try that out today since I'm here. And so we're going to look at the 1953 film from Henry Koster, The Robe. And if you guys recognize The Robe, we play the music every so often from that
movie. It's one of our four rotating theme songs. And a little bit of background. Brendan and I, since we do movie reviews once in a while,
Brendan and I behind the scenes before and after the show, we talk a lot about movies. He had never seen The Robe, so I loaned it to him.
Yes.
And just a couple of weeks ago, he told me that he watched it, he loved it, and he wanted to do a whole show on it.
Yes, absolutely. So from 20th Century Fox, which is now owned, I believe, by Disney, but I doubt Disney's going to put this on Disney Plus anytime soon, but it runs 135 minutes. Interesting fact about Henry Koster, he was part of the Hollywood 10. For those of you who don't know.
Oh, the blacklisted.
That is correct. Yes. Back in McCarthy's days, or the McCarthy era, there was a list of people from Hollywood that were designated as communist, and Henry Koster was accused of being one of those. Obviously, that's not true, and he has gone to direct some of my other great movies I've seen from him, but there's a long list of movies he's
made. On that subject, quick sidebar, have you seen the movie Trumbo, based on Dalton Trumbo? He was the screenwriter who wrote Exodus and Spartacus.
No, I have not.
But he was one of those Hollywood 10.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Wait, and it's all about his censorship, and it's really a phenomenal movie.
Okay, I'll take a look at that. Henry Koster also directed, here are the movies I've seen from his filmography, what I've seen, The Luck of the Irish from 1948, Harvey from 1950, one of Jimmy Stewart's underappreciated roles, may I add.
It's my friend, Harvey.
Who was the Saturday Night Live guy that you said did a really good impression?
Oh, Dana Carvey. Dana Carvey did it. Yeah,
fantastic.
Very good. Yeah.
I can't do it better than him, but he does a really good one. I've also seen Mr. Belvedere Rings the Bell from 1951. I own a copy of Mr. Hobbs Takes a Vacation. I had no idea he directed that. I completely forgot. And lastly, The Seeing Nun as well, which is a classic in itself too, I feel like, from 1966. This film stars Richard Burton, Gene Simmons, Victor Mature, and Michael Rennie. The movie cost $4.1 to $4.6 million, and it made $36 million in the box office at the time.
And to anybody who's never heard of Michael Rennie, if you've seen the classic 1950s sci-fi, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Michael Rennie plays the part of Mr. Carpenter, Klaatu, who comes from the other planet.
Oh, that's pretty good. I love that movie, too. So,
and does it much better than Can a Reason, that idiotic remake.
So, overall, I can't remember this Bible story entirely, so I'm just basing this off the movie itself. I was very, very entertained from start to finish of everything. The exposition at the very beginning was very quick and brisk, but you could follow it from word for word of what, everything of the background of the story that I was trying to tell.
Because the people talked like human beings. They weren't talking with these and thous, and that was one of the things I liked about it.
Personally, I don't mind if you put a text up there. If you want people to understand the background, especially at the time in 1950s, I know that was probably a big thing that they would do, is put text on the screen to let you know, okay, so here's our background of how the story goes. But the overall narration at the very beginning, fine enough. Just first thing that caught my eye was the cinematography. My goodness, the cinematography is just amazing. The first thing that caught my eye was Marcellus Gallio. Am I pronouncing his name correctly? I believe Marcellus Gallio.
Yeah, no, he's not a real historical figure. He was created for the movie, but you are pronouncing it the way they pronounced it in the
movie.
He's
played by Richard Burton.
Excellent job.
Yes, yes. Well, I'll get to him in a second, because I do have some things to say about his performance. But Marcellus is walking through the slave auctions, seeing what's going to be up for bid. That one scene of the camera going above his shoulders, and you're seeing all the action going across, and being able to cut out the sound from one auctioneer to the next auctioneer in one take the entire time, it is really, really awesome, and I really applaud them for that kind of cinematography. Another cinematography, and I also think it's kind of symbolism too, is Marcellus is forced to go to Jerusalem, and I almost felt like that's symbolic for him leaving his sanity as he was going away. It's a foggy thing, and his romantic interest in the movie, I'm trying to remember her name, Diana, that's right. Diana is on the pier, and she's watching as the boat slowly goes into the distance, and it's a foggy distance memory. I almost felt like that was symbolic of his sanity, because eventually, once he gets the robe from Jesus, that turns into him becoming crazy.
Yeah, and it was very much a three-act story, because the action's just nonstop, and the pacing's really heavy all the way up to the crucifixion, and then it really slows down in Act 2 when Marcellus is recovering from the experience he had at Golgotha. Then, of course, Act 3 picks up again, and lots of action and adventure.
I couldn't agree more.
Very well, good way to pace a movie, by the way.
I really, really agree. Another thing I wanted to mention too is I like how it's not so over the top with everything. A movie I was referring to while watching this movie was The Passion of the Christ. I don't mind that movie, but I think it's really over the top in terms of the violence. Like, it really shows the details of everything, and I personally found that uncomfortable to watch, really. In this movie, it's one simple blood drop from Christ being on the crucifix, and that right there tells me enough right there. Like, oh man, this guy's really suffering, and he's, you know, he's watching this guy pass away up there on the cross.
Well, Mel Gibson was trying to do something different with The Passion. He just wanted people to see accurately everything Jesus went through, even before he went to the cross. I look at that and I go, that's a movie everybody should see at least once.
I saw it once.
Robe, I will watch again and again because of the beauty of the way it was filmed.
I agree. Okay, so now here comes the part where I'm a little bit iffy on Richard Burton's performance. I personally thought he was not crazy enough in this movie. I felt like his performances of being crazy or mad while having the robe have its magical powers on him, it was not very good.
Well, he was so withdrawn and monotoned of a character before that I felt that by contrast, he was kind of different when he was going through all those things. But yeah, he was certainly underplaying the role. There is something to be said for underplaying, but he was underplaying.
I will say too, the way he was delivering his dialogue throughout the movie, besides him acting the crazy parts, it felt like any other 1950s actor could have really said these lines, because he's saying it in a very fast and direct way, like most of those 50s actors did at the time.
Well, that was one thing I liked about it, though, because he just seemed like all of us. He seemed like a regular Joe. And the whole idea was this was really not a story about Christ, but a story about somebody learning about Christ. And we're seeing it all through his eyes.
Okay, that's fair enough. The one performance I will mention is Victor Mature's performance. He plays Demetrius, who is at one point Marcellus's slave, but eventually
they become friends.
I thought Victor Mature's performance is fantastic. Now, you told me there's a sequel.
There is a sequel called Demetrius and the Gladiators, and it's not a bad movie, but it's not the brilliant movie that The Robe is.
Would you say he gives the same performance in the second one, probably? In this
He's the same person. It's a little more over the top. In the sequel, he falls from his faith because this girl that he loves, he believes she was killed by the Romans. So he falls from his faith, and Peter returns and restores his faith. It was an interesting sequel. And Caligula, and the actor playing Caligula, is in that sequel. It's worth seeing, and I'm glad they didn't call it The Robe Part 2, but it's not nearly... I like Demetrius. Is it nearly as good as The Robe? No.
Do you own a copy of that
movie? I do. Then? I can give you that one, and you can return that one to me in 6 months. We'll do the same thing we did with The Robe.
Okay. Well, I'll watch it eventually, too, because I really liked his performance. I thought, in terms of when he needed to be somewhat over the top, especially in his dramatic performances, my gosh, I felt like he was extremely
especially saddened. That scene where he said, "I'll never serve you again, you Roman pig," storm. What a dramatic moment
really
that was.
Scene. Yeah. Another scene I really liked from him was when he actually starts following Christ.
When he saw him for the first time and he said, "I think he wants me to follow him."
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And wasn't the music phenomenal throughout? It was a great score.
The score was done by Alfred Newman.
Alfred Newman, not to be confused with Alfred E. Newman, the editor of Mad Magazine. It's a completely different Alfred Newman.
He was nominated for 9 Oscars. He was nominated straight times from 1938 all the way to 1960. That is super.
Did you ever see him in the other biblical drama, Samson and Delilah? He plays Samson. Oh, that's a fun one. Okay. If you like Victor Mature, you got to see Samson and Delilah.
Was that also made in the 1950s?
I believe that was also the 50s. That was done by Cecil B. DeMille, who did the Ten Commandments. It predates the Ten Commandments.
Oh, really?
Okay. And it has all that, you know, you see the whole Colosseum coming down, the Philistine Colosseum this time, not the Roman.
Okay.
It's worth seeing.
Okay. Also, I just want to mention 9 Oscar wins for Alfred Newman. This one was not even nominated out of that. That was insane to me because this music is fantastic from start to finish.
Yeah, now the movie was nominated for Best Picture of the Year. Richard Burton was nominated for Best Actor, did not win, but he did win that at the Golden Globes, and the movie won Best Picture of the Year at the Golden Globes.
That's correct, yes. Some other scores that Alfred Newman did, I just want to point out the ones that I did watch. Airport in 1970, although I don't suggest watching that movie. That one is a very boring movie to sit through.
The movie Airport?
Yeah.
Oh, I liked that movie.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it's just me. Airport.
Well, that was, you got to understand, that was a huge bestseller novel. And, well, there's so much dumb stuff that's going on at airports now. Just thinking about an airport, I'm thinking about wearing a mask all day, so I probably wouldn't enjoy the movie as much now.
Dave Stahl, before you said, you know what? Traveling on the planes as of late has been less fun as a friend. I couldn't agree more.
I used to love it. I used to have an evangelistic itinerant ministry where I went all over the country, and I loved flying on planes. I loved the adventure. I loved the excitement. There's nothing about it that I like anymore.
Surprisingly, I like road trips better.
I like road trips too. My favorite is to take a cruise along Highway 1 all the way up along the ocean the whole way. I love road trips.
Oh, okay. Some other movies that Alfred Newman did as well was The Keenan Eye in 1956. I've seen that one too, and that's a really, really nice movie as well. And lastly, South Pacific. I've only seen the musical.
Of course, these musicals, King and I and South Pacific, it's Rodgers and Hammerstein that wrote the book and the music and lyrics, but Alfred Newman was doing the background score and the variations. And that's a very important part of a movie.
Of course.
Music adds so much.
Of course. So also I want to mention that Leon Shamroy was the cinematographer for the movie. He has 4 Oscar wins and 14 nominations, including this film. It was nominated for Best Cinematography for a color film. Back in the day, they separated the 2 categories for color films.
Yes, because there were so many black and white still.
but some movies that I've only seen 2 films from Leon Shamroy. Cheaper by the Dozen, the old one from 1950.
That was good. I like that
movie. I do
like
the movie, but I don't remember the cinematography being anything special, per se. But the one I know you and I will agree with a lot. He also did the cinematography for Planet of the Apes from 1968.
Oh, I love the original Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston. What a great movie.
Right now, I'm just jumping in excitement right now, just thinking about
it. And you know who wrote the screenplay for that? He didn't write the original novel. That was Pierre Boulez, who wrote Bridge Over the River Kwai. But the screenplay for Planet of the Apes was Rod Serling of the Twilight Zone. He wrote that screenplay.
I did not know
that. And he put in that ending about the Statue of Liberty because it was different in the book. In the book, he really was on another planet and he came back to Earth. But when he got back to Earth, Earth had been taken over by apes also.
Okay. Was the author alive at that time, by any chance?
That's a good question. I do not know. Okay. He may very well not have been, because he probably wouldn't have liked the way they changed his ending. But once a novelist sells his stuff to Hollywood, there's not much he can do whether he's alive or not.
Because it reminds me, there was a movie made in the 2000s called The Mist, I believe, was the name of the movie. It was done by Stephen King. The original ending had the military save the family in the end, and all the alien creatures in the mist were killed by the military. But in the movie, it's done differently, where they think the monsters are about to get them because they hear distant noises of mechanical noises and stuff, and they're not sure if it's alien or something. So the husband says, I will go out and sacrifice myself. You guys need to go out. And we find out that the other family passes away, but he's the only one that survives. And Stephen King actually likes that ending a lot more than the happy ending, because it's a little bit more tragic in the whole thing. So it depends on how you view it. But still, I don't remember reading the book too much. I did read it, but I don't remember the ending too much.
As a general rule, the novel's much better than the movie. There have been a couple of times where I've liked the movie's ending better, but I still feel that out of fairness to the author, they should not have changed it.
Right. But the film of Planet of the Apes, absolute classic, 10 out of 10. Obviously would suggest watching.
Oh, and Charlton Heston was the king of the disaster movies. Then he went on and he did The Omega Man and he did Soylent Green and just laughed all the way to the bank about Earth's apocalyptic future.
So other things to comment for the movie of The Robe. It also won Best Costume Design for a Color Film. Absolutely agree.
Of course, a period piece. If they're not nominated for Best Costume, who are you going to nominate?
Right? So I only have 2 more cons and then I have 1 more pro as well to add to this. The other 2 cons, this one's a nitpick. The special effects are a little cheesy here still. I didn't
notice them even trying to do, what special effect were they even trying to do?
There is a blue spirit that goes into the robe eventually that you see in the movie. And I get it.
You're kidding. Now I can't even count how many times I've seen that movie and I've never noticed that.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be the spirit of God going in there.
They actually show a blue mist going up.
Yes.
I did not notice that.
Yeah, it's very
quick.
Was
it so subtle that we're...
Yeah, exactly. Wow. But again, it's 1953. I'll give it a pass. There's another scene where both Diana and Marcellus are walking up the stairway to heaven, and it slowly transitions from them inside the palace to them actually going up in the sky to heaven. I thought that transition looked a little cheesy because
and then they start singing the Hallelujah chorus and everything.
But again, 1953, I'll give it a pass. It's a nitpick beyond beyond belief. The one, this is the biggest issue I've ever had with this movie here. It was Jay Robinson's performance of Caligula.
Oh, you didn't like that?
Hated it.
Oh, well, I absolutely hated it. It made me hate Caligula, but I guess that made me think that Jay Robinson was being a good actor.
I think Caligula is a very complex character in himself. There was a movie made from back in the 1980s.
That one dealt more with Caligula's himself. Sexuality and
exactly.
stuff. This was more of him being a tyrant.
And even then, that movie is long. Like, I think it's three
well,
hours.
Then you may not like Demetrius and the Gladiators because Caligula is in much more of that from start to finish, and he's even more over the top in that one.
I felt Jay Robinson was chewing up the scenery like crazy.
Buying today, Senator Gallio.
He's jumping up and down from the throne. Kill it! He needs to be put to death.
Oh boy!
And then all of a
perhaps
sudden,
the emperor himself makes mistakes.
And then I even close my eyes really, really hard when everyone's doing the "I'm Spartacus." No, I'm Spartacus. Basically, in the film where everyone says, "Kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him." Everyone starts cheering everyone to put him to death at the end for Marcellus and Diana, because Diana later says, no, if I can't be with him for the rest of my life, then I will be with him the rest of my life up in heaven. Then in that case. So lastly, I will say that's really good is overall the production is fantastic as well. I wanted to give some set pieces their due as well. Like, for example, every time they're into an old little living area where it's stone temples or even the actual palace itself where the emperor sits, it is gorgeous. My goodness. Like you said, if a period piece is
well, that's why it won art direct. That's art direction.
Exactly.
Right there.
If a period piece is not winning art direction or at least nominated for art direction.
Yeah, art direction. And costume. It was nominated for other things too, but it certainly deserved those two wins that
right.
it got.
Yeah, it was a beautiful film. Interesting fact before I get into my grade, ABC paid $2 million for its TV rights back in the day, and it broadcasted its first airing during Easter weekend, and it had 31.0 as a Nielsen rating.
That was in 1967, and I was going to share a piece of trivia. I watched that. I was in the seventh grade. I watched it with my parents. You got to catch this. This is a Jewish family.
Uh-huh.
And my Jewish dad explained what a crucifixion was to me for the very first time. Really gave me my first education about Jesus. The same Jewish dad that was later going to disown me when I got into college because I became a Christian.
Mm. So what did you think of it at the first time when you first watched it?
Well, of course, the idea of Jesus dying for our sin, I didn't understand any of that. I didn't believe it. My parents had taught me that the Bible was a bunch of fairy tales, even the Old Testament, even though they were Jewish. But I found it very interesting. I was intrigued by it. And for a while, ABC was showing it once a year, and I always watched it.
Were your parents?
They were allowing me to watch it. Well, they just weren't worried at that time.
Okay.
At that time, they knew that I loved movies and that everybody assumed I was going to go and become some famous writer or something someday. So they weren't worried because they just chalked it up to my love for drama and theater.
Okay.
Now, another thing I did like about the movies, I like that you never really saw Jesus' face.
I agree.
And you very seldom heard him. Not that we haven't had some good portrayals of Jesus, mm-hmm. but most of them over the years have been horrible.
But also, if you hear Jesus' voice, how comforting is it, actually? I don't remember who was the actor that played Jesus in the film, but his voice is just so, you know, inviting and very
I think
nice.
The only time you even hear Jesus' voice is that one time where he says, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they've done." I don't even remember hearing Jesus any other time.
I want to say there's one other time at the very beginning where he says hello to Demetrius, but I don't think
so, because Demetrius went out of his way to say he didn't speak, only his eyes spoke.
Okay, so I might be wrong on that one. All I know is that his voice was actually very, very nice for the film.
But I like the effect of who is this Jesus and relating to the people around Jesus. Now, I know that there's new productions like The Chosen, where I think the guy that does Jesus does a really good job. But back in those days, when you saw somebody acting Jesus in a movie, they didn't really sell it very well. So I thought movies like The Robe and Ben-Hur did a much better job. Another piece of interesting trivia. One thing I always love, Brendan, is looking at the original movie posters.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you go on Amazon or somewhere and look at the original movie poster, or actually you saw it in the DVD version that I gave you, because sometimes they'll sell a DVD with the original poster, and you look at the three actors drawn on the front, the woman is not Gene Simmons. Now, I don't remember who it was, but there was another actress that was going to play the part. She dropped out at the last minute, and the studio decided not to spend any more money on a new poster. So on there, you're seeing Victor Mature and you're seeing Richard Burton and you're seeing some other Hollywood actress. I wish I could remember what her name was, but it is not Gene Simmons.
Okay, interesting. I have to look at that poster.
Just
again.
Little oh. extra worthless, but no, hopefully no, interesting no. trivia.
Yeah, looking back at the cast, I want to also give a compliment to Richard Boone, who plays Pontius Pilate in the film.
Very good job.
Very. One scene. It's just one scene.
But it was very compelling and very believable. Yeah, yes.
He's tired. He's exhausted. He has to do
And he's also
so
kind
much.
Of underplaying. He wasn't too much over the top.
I thought it was just perfect.
Yes.
Honestly.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. He did a I also liked Dean Jagger as the weaver, the person that was kind of in charge of that little village at Cana.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought Dean Jagger did an excellent job. And then lastly, I will mention as the interesting fact, too, before my grade as well, it is the second highest TV audience for a film behind Can You Name the Movie? Let's see if you
Bridge
can
Over the River Kwai.
That's 60 million viewers during that time. So
well, we've circled back to Bridge Over the River Kwai twice now in this movie with Pierre Boulier, the author writing Planet of the Apes.
So overall, I like to do my film scores out of 10. So that's me. I am going to give it 8 out of 10. I think it's a very, very good film. I will suggest a lot of people to watch it for sure. And if you want to do it as a letter grade like you do, I'll give it a B. I'm willing to push it up to a B+ as well. Because again, most of my stuff I really find are nitpicks. The biggest issue I had for sure was Jay Robinson's performance. But that's just a big nitpick in the whole kit and caboodle of the whole thing. So overall, The Robe, if you could find it on DVD, because it's not available on streaming, you can buy it for $3 if you want.
I'm not as enamored as streaming as everybody else because there is a heck of a lot of stuff that you can't find. And sometimes you find it, and if you stop watching it, you have to pay again to start watching it again.
You're right.
But I would give it an A. And again, you know how critical I am, but if there's a movie we're going out of our way to talk about, it probably means that I like it. So a lot of the movies you hear me talk about on this show, I like. But that's compared to tons and tons and almost anything made today that I don't like.
So yeah, if you can find it on DVD, I don't know if it's on Blu-ray. I'll have to check that. But if you can find
it on
DVD.
I would like to get it on Blu-ray because Blu-ray looks so much better than DVD.
I agree 100%. So if you can find it on DVD, I would say I highly, highly suggest you should go out and find it. If it's going to be available on streaming, watch it as many times as you can there if you want. Because I'm personally a streaming guy myself because it's just right there in front of you. But I totally understand if you're not, if you're old school, if you can find a VHS copy and you have a VHS player still, blow off the
It's
dust
worth
first.
Seeing no matter how you
no
watch
matter
it.
How you watch it, yeah. Well, unfortunately, we did have one more topic, but unfortunately, we are at the end of our program, Bob. So thank you so much
for
we'll
this pick
great
it up.
Movie.
Oh, that was fun. I'm glad you wanted to do it. I love talking about these classics. Okay, folks, we will see you next time. This is Bob Siegel and Brendan Thomas making the obvious obvious.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the law offices of Matthew Simone.